elected leaders. The latter course, by preserving a state of alienation, hinders the emergence of consciousness and critical intervention in a total reality. And without this critical intervention, it is always difficult to achieve the unity of the oppressed as a class. Class conflict is another concept which upsets the oppressors, since they do not wish to consider themselves an oppressive class. Unable to deny, try as they may, the existence of social classes, they preach the need for understanding and harmony between those who buy and those who are obliged to sell their labor. However, the unconcealable antagonism which exists between the two classes makes this harmony impossible. The elites call for harmony between classes, as if classes were fortuitous agglomerations of individuals curiously looking at a shop window on a Sunday afternoon. The only harmony which is viable and demonstrable is that found among the oppressors themselves. Although they may diverge and upon occasion even clash over group interests, they unite immediately at a threat to the class. Similarly, the harmony of the oppressed is only possible when its members are engaged in the struggle for liberation. Only in exceptional cases is it not only possible but necessary for both classes to unite and act in harmony. But when the emergency which united them is past, they will return to the contradiction which defines their existence and which never really disappeared. All the actions of the dominant class manifest its need to divide in order to facilitate the preservation of the oppressor state. Its interference in the unions, favoring certain representatives of the dominated classes, who actually represent the oppressor, not their own comrades, its promotion of individuals who reveal leadership capacity and could signify a threat if they were not softened up in this way, its distribution of benefits to some and penalties to others. All these are ways of dividing in order to preserve the system which favors the elite. They are forms of action which exploit, directly or indirectly, one of the weak points of the oppressed, their basic insecurity. The oppressed are insecure in their duality as beings which house the oppressor. On the one hand, they resist her or him. On the other hand, at a certain stage in their relationship, they are attracted by him or her. Under these circumstances, the oppressors easily obtain positive results from divisive action. In addition, the oppressed know from experience the price of not accepting an invitation offered for the purpose of preventing their unity as a class, losing their jobs and finding their names on a blacklist, signifying closed doors to other jobs, is the least that can happen. Their basic insecurity is thus directly linked to the enslavement of their labor, which really implies the enslavement of their person, as Bishop Split emphasized. People are fulfilled only to the extent that they create their world, which is a human world, and create it with their transforming labor. The fulfillment of humankind as human beings lies then in the fulfillment of the world. If for a person to be in the world of work is to be totally dependent, insecure, and permanently threatened, if their work does not belong to them, the person cannot be fulfilled. Work that is not free ceases to be a fulfilling pursuit and becomes an effective means of dehumanization. Every move by the oppressed towards unity points towards other actions. It means that sooner or later the oppressed will perceive their state of depersonalization and discover that, as long as they are divided, they will always be easy prey for manipulation and domination. Unity and organization can enable them to change their weakness into a transforming force with which they can recreate the world and make it more human. The more human world to which they justly aspire, however, is the antithesis of the human world of the oppressors, a world which is the exclusive possession of the oppressors who preach an impossible harmony between themselves who dehumanize and the oppressed who are dehumanized. Since oppressors and oppressed are antithetical, what serves the interests of one group deserves the interests of the others. Dividing in order to preserve the status quo, then, is necessarily a fundamental objective of the theory of anti-dialogical action. In addition, the dominators try to present themselves as saviors of the women and men they dehumanize and divide. This messianism, however, cannot conceal their true intention, to save themselves. They want to save their riches, their power, their way of life, the things that enable them to subjugate others. Their mistake is that men cannot save themselves, no matter how one understands salvation, either as individuals or as an oppressor class. Salvation can be achieved only with others. To the extent, however, that the elites oppress, they cannot be with the oppressed, for being against them is the essence of oppression. A psychoanalysis of oppressive action might reveal the false generosity of the oppressor described in chapter 1 as a dimension of the latter's sense of guilt. With this false generosity, he attempts not only to preserve an unjust and necrophilic order, but to buy peace for himself. It happens that peace cannot be bought. Peace is experienced in solidary and loving acts, which cannot be incarnated in oppression. Hence, the messianic element of the theory of anti-dialogical action reinforces the first characteristic of this action, the necessity for conquest. Since it is necessary to divide the people in order to preserve the status quo, and thereby the power of the dominators, it is essential for the oppressors to keep the oppressed from perceiving their strategy. So the former must convince the latter that they are being defended against the demonic action of marginals, rowdies, and enemies of God, for these are the epithets directed at men who lived and are living the brave pursuit of man's humanization. In order to divide and confuse the people, the destroyers call themselves builders and accuse the true builders of being destructive. History, however, always takes it upon itself to modify these designations. Today, although the official terminology continues to call Tiradentes as a conspirator, Inconfidente, and the libertarian movement which he led a conspiracy, Inconfidencia, the national hero is not the man who called Tiradentes a bandit, ordered him hanged and quartered, and had pieces of the bloody corpse strewn through the streets of the neighboring villages as an example. It is Tiradentes who is the hero. History tore up the title given him by the elites and recognized his action for what it was. It is the men who in their own time sought unity for liberation who are the heroes, not those who used their power to divide and rule. Manipulation. Manipulation is another dimension of the theory of anti-dialogical action, and, like the strategy of division, is an instrument of conquest, the objective around which all the dimensions of the theory revolve. By means of manipulation, the dominant elites try to conform the masses to their objectives, and the greater the political immaturity of these people, rural or urban, the more easily the latter can be manipulated by those who do not wish to lose their power. The people are manipulated by the series of myths described earlier in this chapter, and by yet another myth, the model of itself which the bourgeoisie presents to the people as the possibility for their own ascent. In order for these myths to function, however, the people must accept the word of the bourgeoisie. Within certain historical conditions, manipulation is accomplished by means of pacts between the dominant and the dominated classes, pacts which, if considered superficially, might give the impression of a dialogue between the classes. In reality, however, these pacts are not dialogue, because their true objectives are determined by the unequivocal interest of the dominant elites. In the last analysis, pacts are used by the dominators to achieve their own ends. The support given by the people to the so-called national bourgeoisie in defense of so-called national capitalism is an example in point. Sooner or later, these pacts always increase the subjugation of the people. They are proposed only when the people begin, even naively, to emerge from the historical process, and by this emergence, to threaten the dominant elites. The presence of the people in the historical process, no longer as mere spectators, but with the first signs of aggressivity, is sufficiently disquieting to frighten the dominant elites into doubling the tactics of manipulation. In this historical phase, manipulation becomes a fundamental instrument for the preservation of domination. Prior to the emergence of the people, there is no manipulation, precisely speaking, but rather total suppression. When the oppressed are almost completely submerged in reality, it is unnecessary to manipulate them. In the anti-dialogical theory of action, manipulation is the response of the oppressor to the new concrete conditions of the historical process. Through manipulation, the dominant elites can lead the people into an unauthentic type of organization, and can thus avoid the threatening alternative, the true organization of the emerged and emerging people. The latter have only two possibilities as they enter the historical process. Either they must organize authentically for their liberation, or they will be manipulated by the elites. Authentic organization is obviously not going to be stimulated by the dominators. It is the task of the revolutionary leaders. It happens, however, that large sectors of the oppressed form an urban proletariat, especially in the more industrialized centers of the country. Although these sectors are occasionally restive, they lack revolutionary consciousness and consider themselves privileged. Manipulation, with its series of deceits and promises, usually finds fertile ground here. The antidote to manipulation lies in a critically conscious revolutionary organization, which will pose to the people as problems their position in the historical process, the national reality, and manipulation itself. In the words of Francisco Huevet, all the policies of the left are based on the masses and depend on the consciousness of the latter. If that consciousness is confused, the left will lose its roots and certain downfall will be imminent, although, as in the Brazilian case, the left may be deluded into thinking it can achieve the revolution by means of a quick return to power. In a situation of manipulation, the left is almost always tempted by a quick return to power, forgets the necessity of joining with the oppressed to forge an organization, and strays into an impossible dialogue with the dominant elites. It ends by being manipulated by these elites, and not infrequently itself, falls into an elitist game, which it calls realism. Manipulation, like the conquest whose objectives it serves, attempts to anesthetize the people so they will not think. For if the people join to their presence in the historical process critical thinking about that process, the threat of their emergence materializes in revolution. Whether one calls this correct thinking revolutionary consciousness or class consciousness, it is an indispensable precondition of revolution. The dominant elites are so well aware of this fact that they instinctively use all means, including physical violence, to keep the people from thinking. They have a shrewd intuition of the ability of dialogue to develop a capacity for criticism. While some revolutionary leaders consider dialogue with the people a bourgeois and reactionary activity, the bourgeoisie regard dialogue between the oppressed and the revolutionary leaders as a very real danger to be avoided. One of the methods of manipulation is to inoculate individuals with a bourgeois appetite for personal success. This manipulation is sometimes carried out directly by the elites and sometimes indirectly through populist leaders. As Huevet points out, these leaders serve as intermediaries between the oligarchical elites and the people. The emergence of populism as a style of political action thus coincides causally with the emergence of the oppressed. The populist leader who rises from this process is an ambiguous being, an amphibian who lives in two elements. Shuttling back and forth between the people and the dominant oligarchies, he bears the marks of both groups. Since the populist leader simply manipulates instead of fighting for authentic popular organization, this type of leader serves the revolution little, if at all. Only by abandoning his ambiguous character and dual action, and by opting decisively for the people, thus ceasing to be populist, does he renounce manipulation and dedicate himself to the revolutionary task of organization. At this point, he ceases to be an intermediary between the people and the elites, and becomes a contradiction of the latter, Thereupon the elites immediately joined forces to curb him. Observe the dramatic and finally unequivocal terms in which Getulio Vargas spoke to the workers at a May 1 celebration during his last period as head of state. "I want to tell you that the gigantic work of renewal which my administration is beginning to carry out cannot be completed successfully without the support and the daily steadfast cooperation of the workers." Vargas then spoke of his first 90 days in office, which he called an estimate of the difficulties and obstacles which, here and there, are being raised in opposition to the actions of the government. He spoke directly to the people about how deeply he felt the helplessness, poverty, the high cost of living, low salaries, the hopelessness of the unfortunate, and the demands of the majority who live in hope of better days. His appeal to the workers then took on more objective tones. "I have come to say that at this moment the administration does not yet have the laws or the concrete instruments for immediate action to defend the people's economy. It is thus necessary for the people to organize, not only to defend their own interests, but also to give the government the base of support it requires to carry out its objectives. I need your unity. I need for you, in solidarity, to organize yourselves in unions. I need for you to form a strong and cohesive bloc to stand beside the government so that it will have all the force it needs to solve your problems. I need your unity so you can fight against saboteurs, so you do not fall prey to the interests of speculators and rapacious scoundrels in detriment of the interests of the people. The hour has come to appeal to the workers. Unite in your unions as free and organized forces. At the present time, no administration can survive or dispose of sufficient force to achieve its social ends if it does not have the support of all laboring organizations." In sum, in this speech, Vargas appealed vehemently to the people to organize and to unite in defense of their rights, and he told them, as chief of state, of the obstacles, the hindrances, and the innumerable difficulties involving in governing with them. From that moment on, his administration encountered increasing difficulties until the tragic climax of August 1954. If Vargas had not in his last term shown such open encouragement to the organization of the people, subsequently linked to a series of measures in defense of the national interest, possibly the reactionary elites would not have taken the extreme measures they did. Any populist leader who moves even discreetly towards the people in any way other than as the intermediary of the oligarchies will be curbed by the latter, if they have sufficient force to stop him. But as long as the leader restricts himself to paternalism and social welfare activities, although there may be occasional divergences between him and groups of oligarchies whose interests have been touched, deep differences are rare. This is because welfare programs as instruments of manipulation ultimately serve the end of conquest. They act as an anesthetic, distracting the oppressed from the true causes of their problems and from the concrete solution of their problems. They splinter the oppressed into groups of individuals, hoping to get a few more benefits for themselves. This situation contains, however, a positive element. The individuals who receive some aid always want more. Those who do not receive aid, seeing the example of those who do, grow envious and also want assistance. Since the dominant elites cannot aid everyone, they end up by increasing the restiveness of the oppressed. The revolutionary leader should take advantage of the contradictions of manipulation by posing it as a problem to the oppressed, with the objective of organizing them. Cultural invasion. The theory of anti-dialogical action has one last fundamental characteristic, cultural invasion, which, like divisive tactics and manipulation, also serves the end of conquest. In this phenomenon, the invaders penetrate the cultural context of another group, in disrespect of the latter's potentialities. They impose their own view of the world upon those they invade and inhibit the creativity of the invaded by curbing their expression. Whether urbane or harsh, cultural invasion is thus always an act of violence against the persons of the invaded culture, who lose their originality or face the threat of losing it. In cultural invasion, as in the modalities of anti-dialogical action, the invaders are the authors of and actors in the process. Those they invade are the objects. The invaders mold. Those they invade are molded. The invaders choose. Those they invade follow that choice, or are expected to follow it. The invaders act. Those they invade only have the illusion of acting through the action of the invaders. All domination involves invasion, at times physical and overt, at times camouflaged, with the invader assuming the role of a helping friend. In the last analysis, invasion is a form of economic and cultural domination. Invasion may be practiced by a metropolitan society upon a dependent society, or it may be implicit in the domination of one class over another within the same society. Cultural conquest leads to the cultural inauthenticity of those who are invaded. They begin to respond to the values, the standards, and the goals of the invaders. In their passion to dominate, to mold others to their patterns and their way of life, the invaders desire to know how those they have invaded apprehend reality, but only so they can dominate the latter more effectively. In cultural invasion, it is essential that those who are invaded come to see their reality with the outlook of the invaders rather than their own, for the more they mimic the invaders, the more stable the position of the latter becomes. For cultural invasion to succeed, it is essential that those invaded become convinced of their intrinsic inferiority. Since everything has its opposite, if those who are invaded consider themselves inferior, they must necessarily recognize the superiority of the invaders. The values of the latter thereby become the pattern for the former. The more invasion is accentuated, and those invaded are alienated from the spirit of their own culture and from themselves, the more the latter want to be like the invaders, to walk like them, dress like them, talk like them. The social eye of the invaded person, like every social eye, is formed in the socio-cultural relations of the social structure, and therefore reflects the duality of the invaded culture. This duality, which was described earlier, explains why invaded and dominated individuals at a certain moment of their existential experience almost adhere to the oppressor thou. The oppressed I must break with this near adhesion to the oppressor thou, drawing away from the latter in order to see him more objectively, at which point she critically recognizes herself to be in contradiction with the oppressor. In so doing, he considers as a dehumanizing reality the structure in which he is being oppressed. This qualitative change in the perception of the world can only be achieved in the praxis. Cultural invasion is on the one hand an instrument of domination, and on the other, the result of domination. Thus cultural action of a dominating character, like other forms of anti-dialogical action, in addition to being deliberate and planned, is in another sense simply a product of oppressive reality. For example, a rigid and oppressive social structure necessarily influences the institutions of child-rearing and education within that structure. These institutions pattern their action after the style of the structure and transmit the myths of the latter. Homes and schools, from nurseries to universities, exist not in the abstract, but in time and space. Within the structures of domination, they function largely as agencies which prepare the invaders of the future. The parent-child relationship in the home usually reflects the objective cultural conditions of the surrounding social structure. If the conditions which penetrate the home are authoritarian, rigid, and dominating, the home will increase the climate of oppression. As these authoritarian relations between parents and children intensify, children in their infancy increasingly internalize the paternal authority. Presenting with these customary clarity the problem of necrophilia and biophilia, Fromm analyzes the objective conditions which generate each condition, whether in the home, parent-child relations in a climate of indifference and oppression, or of love and freedom, or in a socio-cultural context. If children reared in an atmosphere of lovelessness and oppression, children whose potency has been frustrated, do not manage during their youth to take the path of authentic rebellion, they will either drift into total indifference, alienated from reality by the authorities and the myths the latter have used to shape them, or they may engage in forms of destructive action. The atmosphere of the home is prolonged in the school, where the students soon discover that, as in the home, in order to achieve some satisfaction, they must adapt to the precepts which have been set from above. One of these precepts is not to think. Internalizing paternal authority through the rigid relationship structure emphasized by the school, these young people tend, when they become professionals, because of the very fear of freedom instilled by these relationships, to repeat the rigid patterns in which they were miseducated. This phenomenon, in addition to their class position, perhaps explains why so many professionals adhere to anti-dialogical action. Whatever the specialty that brings them into contact with the people, they are almost unshakably convinced that it is their mission to give the latter their knowledge and techniques. They see themselves as promoters of the people. Their programs of action, which might have been prescribed by any good theorist of oppressive action, include their own objectives, their own convictions, and their own preoccupations. They do not listen to the people, but instead plan to teach them how to cast off the laziness which creates underdevelopment. To these professionals, it seems absurd to consider the necessity of respecting the view of the world held by the people. The professionals are the ones with a world view. They regard as equally absurd the affirmation that one must necessarily consult the people when organizing the program content of educational action. They feel that the ignorance of the people is so complete that they are unfit for anything except to receive the teachings of the professionals. When, however, at a certain point of their existential experience, those who have been invaded begin in one way or another to reject this invasion, to which they might earlier have adapted, the professionals, in order to justify their failure, say that the members of the invaded group are inferior because they are ingrates, shiftless, diseased, or of mixed blood. Well-intentioned professionals, those who use invasion not as deliberate ideology but as the expression of their own upbringing, eventually discover that certain of their educational failures must be ascribed not to the intrinsic inferiority of the simple men of the people, but to the violence of their own act of invasion. Those who make this discovery face a difficult alternative. They feel the need to renounce invasion, but patterns of domination are so entrenched within them that this renunciation would become a threat to their own identities. To renounce invasion would mean ending their dual status as dominated and dominators. It would mean abandoning all the myths which nourish invasion and starting to incarnate dialogical action. For this very reason, it would mean to cease being over or inside as foreigners in order to be with as comrades. And so the fear of freedom takes hold of these men. During this traumatic process, they naturally tend to rationalize their fear with a series of evasions. The fear of freedom is greater still in professionals who have not yet discovered for themselves the invasive nature of their action and who are told that their action is dehumanizing. Not infrequently, especially at the point of decoding concrete situations, training course participants ask the coordinator in an irritated manner, "Where do you think you're steering us anyway?" The coordinator isn't trying to steer them anywhere. It is just that in facing a concrete situation as a problem, the participants begin to realize that if their analysis of the situation goes any deeper, they will either have to divest themselves of their myths or reaffirm them. Divesting themselves of and renouncing their myths represents, at that moment, an act of self-violence. On the other hand, to reaffirm those myths is to reveal themselves. The only way out, which functions as a defense mechanism, is to project onto the coordinator their own usual practices, steering, conquering, and invading. The same retreat occurs, though on a smaller scale, among men of the people who have been ground down by the concrete situation of oppression and domesticated by charity. One of the teachers of Full Circle, which carried out a valuable educational program in New York City under the coordination of Robert Fox, relates the following incident. A group in a New York ghetto was presented a coded situation showing a big pile of garbage on a street corner, the very same street where the group was meeting. One of the participants said at once, "I see a street in Africa or Latin America." "And why not in New York?" asked the teacher. "Because we are the United States, and that can't happen here." Beyond a doubt, this man and some of his comrades who agreed with him were retreating from a reality so offensive to them that even to acknowledge that reality was threatening. For an alienated person, conditioned by a culture of achievement and personal success, to recognize his situation as objectively unfavorable seems to hinder his own possibilities of success. In the case cited and in that of the professionals, the determining force of the culture which develops the myths men subsequently internalize is evident. In both cases, the culture of the dominant class hinders the affirmation of men as beings of decision. Neither the professionals nor the discussion participants in the New York slums talk and act for themselves as active subjects of the historical process. None of them are theoreticians or ideologues of domination. On the contrary, they are effects which in turn become causes of domination. This is one of the most serious problems the revolution must confront when it reaches power. This stage demands maximum political wisdom, decision, and courage from the leaders, who for this very reason must have sufficient judgment not to fall into irrationally sectarian positions. Professional women and men of any specialty, university graduates or not, are individuals who have been determined from above by a culture of domination which has constituted them as dual beings. If they had come from the lower classes, this miseducation would be the same, if not worse. These professionals, however, are necessary to the reorganization of the new society. And since many among them, even though afraid of freedom and reluctant to engage in humanizing action, are in truth more misguided than anything else, they not only could be, but ought to be reclaimed by the revolution. This reclamation requires that the revolutionary leaders, progressing from what was previously dialogical cultural action, initiate the cultural revolution. At this point, revolutionary power moves beyond its role as a necessary obstacle confronting those who wish to negate humanity and assumes a new and bolder position with a clear invitation to all who wish to participate in the reconstruction of society. In this sense, cultural revolution is a necessary continuation of the dialogical cultural action which must be carried out before the revolution reaches power. Cultural revolution takes the total society to be reconstructed, including all human activities, as the object of its remolding action. Society cannot be reconstructed in a mechanistic fashion. The culture which is culturally recreated through revolution is the fundamental instrument for this reconstruction. Cultural revolution is the revolutionary regime's maximum effort at conscientisation. It should reach everyone, regardless of their personal path. Consequently, this effort at conscientisation cannot rest content with the technical or scientific training of intended specialists. The new society becomes qualitatively distinct from the old in more than a partial way. Revolutionary society cannot attribute to technology the same ends attributed by the previous society. Accordingly, the training of people in the two societies must also differ. Technical and scientific training need not be inimical to humanistic education, as long as science and technology in the revolutionary society are at the service of permanent liberation of humanization. From this point of view, the training of individuals for any occupation, since all occupations occur in time and space, requires the understanding of A, culture as a superstructure which can maintain remnants of the past alive in the substructure undergoing revolutionary transformation, and B, the occupation itself as an instrument for the transformation of culture. As the cultural revolution deepens, Conscientizazao, in the creative praxis of the new society, people will begin to perceive why mythical remnants of the old society survive in the new. And they will then be able to free themselves more rapidly of these specters, which, by hindering the edification of a new society, have always constituted a serious problem for every revolution. Through these cultural remnants, the oppressor society continues to invade, this time invading the revolutionary society itself. This invasion is especially terrible because it is carried out not by the dominant elite reorganized as such, but by those who have participated in the revolution. As men who house the oppressor, they resist as might the latter themselves the further basic steps which the revolution must take. And as dual beings, they also accept, still due to the remnants, power which becomes bureaucratized and which violently represses them. In turn, this violently repressive bureaucratic power can be explained by what Althusser calls the reactivation of old elements in the new society each time special circumstances permit. For all the above reasons, I interpret the revolutionary process as dialogical cultural action which is prolonged in cultural revolution once power is taken. In both stages, a serious and profound effort at conscientizazao, by means of which the people, through a true praxis, leave behind the status of objects to assume the status of historical subjects, is necessary. Finally, cultural revolution develops the practice of permanent dialogue between leaders and people, and consolidates the participation of the people in power. In this way, as both leaders and people continue their critical activity, the revolution will more easily be able to defend itself against bureaucratic tendencies, which lead to new forms of oppression, and against invasion, which is always the same. The invader, whether in a bourgeois or in a revolutionary society, may be an agronomist or sociologist, an economist or a public health engineer, a priest or a pastor, an educator or a social worker, or a revolutionary. Cultural invasion, which serves the ends of conquest and the preservation of oppression, always involves a parochial view of reality, a static perception of the world, and the imposition of one worldview upon another. It implies the superiority of the invader and the inferiority of those who are invaded, as well as the imposition of values by the former, who possess the latter and are afraid of losing them. Cultural invasion further signifies that the ultimate seat of decision regarding the action of those who are invaded lies not with them, but with the invaders. And when the power of decision is located outside rather than within the one who should decide, the latter has only the illusion of deciding. This is why there can be no socio-economic development in a dual-reflex invaded society. For development to occur, it is necessary, A, that there be a movement of search and creativity having its seat of decision in the searcher, B, that this movement occur not only in space, but in the existential time of the conscious searcher. Thus, while all development is transformation, not all transformation is development. The transformation occurring in a seed which under favorable conditions germinates and sprouts is not development. In the same way, the transformation of an animal is not development. The transformations of seeds and animals are determined by the species to which they belong, and they occur in a time which does not belong to them, for time belongs to humankind. Women and men, among the uncompleted beings, are the only ones which develop. As historical, autobiographical beings for themselves, their transformation development occurs in their own existential time, never outside it. Men who are submitted to concrete conditions of oppression in which they become alienated beings for another, of the false being for himself, on whom they depend, are not able to develop authentically. Deprived of their own power of decision which is located in the oppressor, they follow the prescriptions of the latter. The oppressed only begin to develop when, surmounting the contradiction in which they are caught, they become beings for themselves. If we consider society as a being, it is obvious that only a society which is a being for itself can develop. Societies which are dual reflex invaded and dependent on the metropolitan society cannot develop because they are alienated, their political, economic, and cultural decision-making power is located outside themselves in the invader society. In the last analysis, the latter determines the destiny of the former, mere transformation, for it is their transformation, not their development, that is to the interest of the metropolitan society. It is essential not to confuse modernization with development. The former, although it may affect certain groups in the satellite society, is almost always induced, and it is the metropolitan society which derives the true benefits therefrom. A society which is merely modernized without developing will continue, even if it takes over some minimal delegated powers of decision, to depend on the outside country. This is the fate of any dependent society as long as it remains dependent. In order to determine whether or not a society is developing, one must go beyond criteria based on indices of per capita income, which expressed in statistical form are misleading, as well as those which concentrate on the study of gross income. The basic elementary criterion is whether or not the society is a being for itself. If it is not, the other criteria indicate modernization rather than development. The principal contradiction of dual societies is the relationship of dependency between them and the metropolitan society. Once the contradiction has been superseded, the transformation hitherto effected through aid, which has primarily benefited the metropolitan society, becomes true development, which benefits the being for itself. For the above reasons, the purely reformist solutions attempted by these societies, even though some of the reforms may frighten and even panic the more reactionary members of the elite groups, do not resolve their external and internal contradictions. Almost always, the metropolitan society induces these reformist solutions in response to the demands of the historical process as a new way of preserving its hegemony. It is as if the metropolitan society were saying, "Let us carry out reforms before the people carry out a revolution." And in order to achieve this goal, the metropolitan society has no options other than conquest, manipulation, economic and cultural, and sometimes military invasion of the dependent society, an invasion in which the elite leaders of the dominated society to a large extent act as mere brokers for the leaders of the metropolitan society. To close this tentative analysis of the theory of anti-dialogical action, I wish to reaffirm that revolutionary leaders must not use the same anti-dialogical procedures used by the oppressors. On the contrary, revolutionary leaders must follow the path of dialogue and of communication. Before proceeding to analyze the theory of dialogical action, it is essential to discuss briefly how the revolutionary leadership group is formed and some of the historical and sociological consequences for the revolutionary process. Usually this leadership group is made up of men and women who in one way or another have belonged to the social strata of the dominators. At a certain point in their existential experience, under certain historical conditions, these leaders renounce the class to which they belong and join the oppressed in an act of true solidarity, or so one would hope. Whether or not this adherence results from a scientific analysis of reality, it represents, when authentic, an act of love and true commitment. Joining the oppressed requires going to them and communicating with them. The people must find themselves in emerging leaders, and the latter must find themselves in the people. The leaders who have emerged necessarily reflect the contradiction of the dominant elites communicated to them by the oppressed, who may not yet, however, clearly perceive their own state of oppression or critically recognize their relationship of antagonism to the oppressors. They may still be in the position previously termed adhesion to the oppressor. On the other hand, it is possible that due to certain objective historical conditions, they have already reached a relatively clear perception of their state of oppression. In the first case, the adhesion or partial adhesion of the people to the oppressor makes it impossible for them to repeat Fanon's point to locate him outside themselves. In the second case, they can locate the oppressor and can thus critically recognize their relationship of antagonism to him. In the first case, the oppressor is housed within the people, and their resulting ambiguity make them fearful of freedom. They resort, stimulated by the oppressor, to magical explanations or a false view of God, to whom they fatalistically transfer the responsibility for their oppressed state. It is extremely unlikely that these self-mistrustful, downtrodden, hopeless people will seek their own liberation, an act of rebellion which they may view as a disobedient violation of the will of God, as an unwarranted confrontation with destiny. Hence the oft-emphasized necessity of posing as problems the myths fed to the people by the oppressors. In the second case, when the people have reached a relatively clear picture of oppression, which leads them to localize the oppressor outside themselves, they take up the struggle to surmount the contradiction in which they are caught. At this moment, they overcome the distance between class necessity and class consciousness. In the first case, the revolutionary leaders, unfortunately and involuntarily, become the contradiction of the people. In the second case, the emerging leaders receive from the people sympathetic and almost instantaneous support, which tends to increase during the process of revolutionary action. The leaders go to the people in a spontaneously dialogical manner. There is an almost immediate empathy between the people and the revolutionary leaders. Their mutual commitment is almost instantly sealed. In fellowship, they consider themselves co-equal contradictions of the dominant elites. From this point on, the established practice of dialogue between people and leaders is nearly unshakable. That dialogue will continue when power is reached, and the people will know that they have come to power. This sharing in no way diminishes the spirit of struggle, courage, capacity for love, or daring required of the revolutionary leaders. Fidel Castro and his comrades, whom many at the time termed irresponsible adventurers, an eminently dialogical leadership group, identified with the people who endure the brutal violence of the Batista dictatorship. This adherence was not easy. It required bravery on the part of the leaders to love the people sufficiently to be willing to sacrifice themselves for them. It required courageous witness by the leaders to recommence after each disaster, moved by undying hope in a future victory which, because forged together with the people, would belong not to the leaders alone, but to the leaders and the people, or to the people including the leaders. Fidel gradually polarized the adherence of the Cuban people, who, due to their historical experience, had already begun to break their adhesion to the oppressor. This drawing away from the oppressor led the people to objectify him and to see themselves as his contradiction. So it was that Fidel never entered into contradiction with the people. The occasional desertions or betrayals registered by Guevara in his Relato de la Guerra Revolucionaria, in which he also refers to the many who adhered, were to be expected. Thus, due to certain historical conditions, the movement by the revolutionary leaders to the people is either horizontal, so that leaders and people form one body in contradiction to the oppressor, or it is triangular, with the revolutionary leaders occupying the vertex of the triangle in contradiction to the oppressors and to the oppressed as well. As we have seen, the latter situation is forced on the leaders when the people have not yet achieved a critical perception of oppressive reality. Almost never, however, does a revolutionary leadership group perceive that it constitutes a contradiction to the people. Indeed, this perception is painful, and the resistance may serve as a defense mechanism. After all, it is not easy for leaders who have emerged through adherence to the oppressed to recognize themselves as being in contradiction with those to whom they adhered. It is important to recognize this reluctance when analyzing certain forms of behavior on the part of revolutionary leaders who involuntarily become a contradiction, although not antagonists of the people. In order to carry out the revolutionary leaders undoubtedly require the adherence of the people. When leaders who constitute a contradiction to the people seek this adherence and find rather a certain aloofness and mistrust, they often regard this reaction as indicating an inherent defect on the part of the people. They interpret a certain historical moment of the people's consciousness as evidence of their intrinsic deficiency. Since the leaders need the adherence of the people so that the revolution can be achieved, but at the same time mistrust the mistrustful people, they are tempted to utilize the same procedures used by the dominant elites to oppress. Rationalizing their lack of confidence in the people, the leaders say it is impossible to dialogue with the people before taking power, thus opting for the anti-dialogical theory of action. Thenceforward, just like the dominant elites, they try to conquer the people. They become messianic. They use manipulation and carry out cultural invasion. By advancing along these paths, the paths of oppression, they will not achieve revolution, or if they do, it will not be authentic revolution. The role of revolutionary leadership under any circumstances, but especially so in those described, is to consider seriously, even as they act, the reasons for any attitude of mistrust on the part of the people, and to seek out true avenues of communion with them. Ways of helping the people to help themselves critically perceive the reality which oppresses them. The dominated consciousness is dual, ambiguous, full of fear and mistrust. In his diary about the struggle in Bolivia, Guevara refers several times to the lack of peasant participation. The peasant mobilization does not exist except for informative duties which annoy us somewhat. They are neither very rapid nor very efficient. They can be neutralized. Complete lack of incorporation of the peasants, although they are losing their fear of us and we are succeeding in winning their admiration. It is a slow and patient task. The internalization of the oppressor by the dominated consciousness of the peasants explains their fear and their inefficiency. The behavior and reactions of the oppressed, which lead the oppressor to practice cultural invasion, should evoke from the revolutionary a different theory of action. What distinguishes revolutionary leaders from the dominant elite is not only their objectives, but their procedures. If they act in the same way, the objectives become identical. It is self-contradictory for the dominant elites to pose human-world relations as problems to the people, as it is for the revolutionary leaders not to do so. Let us now analyze the theory of dialogical cultural action and attempt to apprehend its constituent elements. Cooperation. In the theory of anti-dialogical action, conquest, as its primary characteristic, involves a subject who conquers another person and transforms her or him into a thing. In a dialogical theory of action, subjects meet in cooperation in order to transform the world. The anti-dialogical, dominating I transforms the dominated, conquered thou into a mere it. The dialogical I, however, knows that it is precisely the thou, not I, which has called forth his or her own existence. He also knows that the thou which calls forth his own existence in turn constitutes an I which has in his I its thou. The I and the thou thus become, in the dialectic of these relationships, two thous which become two I's. The dialogical theory of action does not involve a subject who dominates by virtue of conquest and a dominated object. Instead, there are subjects who meet to name the world in order to transform it. If at a certain historical moment the oppressed, for the reasons previously described, are unable to fulfill their vocation as subjects, the posing of their very oppression as a problem, which always involves some form of action, will help them achieve this vocation. The above does not mean that in the dialogical task there is no role for revolutionary leadership. It means merely that the leaders, in spite of their important, fundamental, and indispensable role, do not own the people and have no right to steer the people blindly towards their salvation. Such salvation would be a mere gift from the leaders to the people, a breaking of the dialogical bond between them, and a reducing of the people from co-authors of liberating action into the objects of this action. Cooperation as a characteristic of dialogical action, which occurs only among subjects, who may, however, have diverse levels of functions and thus of responsibility, can only be achieved through communication. Dialogue, as essential communication, must underlie any cooperation. In the theory of dialogical action, there is no place for conquering the people on behalf of the revolutionary cause, but only for gaining their adherence. Dialogue does not impose, does not manipulate, does not domesticate, does not sloganize. This does not mean, however, that the theory of dialogical action leads nowhere, nor does it mean that the dialogical human does not have a clear idea of what she wants or of the objectives to which she is committed. The commitment of the revolutionary leaders to the oppressed is at the same time a commitment to freedom. And because of that commitment, the leaders cannot attempt to conquer the oppressed, but must achieve their adherence to liberation. Conquered adherence is not adherence, it is adhesion of the vanquished to the conqueror, who prescribes the options open to the former. Authentic adherence is the free coincidence of choices. It cannot occur apart from communication among people, mediated by reality. Thus, cooperation leads dialogical subjects to focus their attention on the reality, which mediates them and which, posed as a problem, challenges them. The response to that challenge is the action of dialogical subjects upon reality in order to transform it. Let me re-emphasize that posing reality as a problem does not mean sloganizing. It means critical analysis of a problematic reality. As opposed to the mythicizing practices of the dominant elites, dialogical theory requires that the world be unveiled. No one can, however, unveil the world for another. Although one subject may initiate the unveiling on behalf of others, the others must also become subjects of this act. The adherence of the people is made possible by this unveiling of the world and of themselves in authentic praxis. This adherence coincides with the trust the people begin to place in themselves and in the revolutionary leaders as the former perceive the dedication and authenticity of the latter. The trust of the people in the leaders reflects the confidence of the leaders in the people. This confidence should not, however, be naive. The leaders must believe in the potentialities of the people, whom they cannot treat as mere objects of their own action. They must believe that the people are capable of participating in the pursuit of liberation. But they must always mistrust the ambiguity of oppressed people, mistrust the oppressor housed in the latter. Accordingly, when Guevara exhorts the revolutionary to be always mistrustful, he is not disregarding the fundamental condition of the theory of dialogical action. He is merely being a realist. Although trust is basic to dialogue, it is not an a priori condition of the latter. It results from the encounter in which persons are co-subjects in denouncing the world as part of the world's transformation. But as long as the oppressor within the oppressed is stronger than they themselves are, their natural fear of freedom may lead them to denounce the revolutionary leaders instead. The leaders cannot be credulous, but must be alert for these possibilities. Guevara's episodes confirms these risks, not only desertions, but even betrayal of the cause. At times in this document, while recognizing the necessity of punishing the deserter in order to preserve the cohesion and discipline of the group, Guevara also recognizes certain factors which explain the desertion. One of them, perhaps the most important, is the deserter's ambiguity. Another portion of Guevara's document, which refers to his presence not only as a guerrilla but as a medical doctor in a peasant community in the Sierra Maestra, and relates to our discussion of cooperation, is quite striking. As a result of daily contact with these people and their problems, we became firmly convinced of the need for a complete change in the life of our people. The idea of an agrarian reform became crystal clear. Communion with the people ceased to be a mere theory, to become an integral part of ourselves. Guerrillas and peasants began to merge into a solid mass. No one can say exactly when, in this long process, the ideas became reality and we became a part of the peasantry. As far as I'm concerned, the contact with my patients in the Sierra turned a spontaneous and somewhat lyrical decision into a more serene force, one of an entirely different value. Those poor, suffering, loyal inhabitants of the Sierra cannot even imagine what a great contribution they made to the forging of our revolutionary ideology. Note Guevara's emphasis that communion with the people was decisive for the transformation of a spontaneous and somewhat lyrical decision into a more serene force, one of an entirely different value. It was then, in dialogue with the peasants, that Guevara's revolutionary praxis became definitive. What Guevara did not say, perhaps due to humility, is that it was his own humility and capacity to love that made possible his communion with the people. And this indisputably dialogical communion became cooperation. Note that Guevara, who did not climb the Sierra Maestra with Fidel and his comrades as a frustrated youth in search of adventure, recognizes that his communion with the people ceased to be a mere theory to become an integral part of himself. He stresses how, from the moment of that communion, the peasants became forgers of his guerrilla's revolutionary ideology. Even Guevara's unmistakable style of narrating his and his comrades' experiences, of describing his contacts with the poor, loyal peasants in almost evangelical language, reveals this remarkable man's deep capacity for love and communication. Thence emerges the force of his ardent testimony to the work of another loving man, Camilo Torres, the guerrilla priest. Without the communion which engenders true cooperation, the Cuban people would have been mere objects of the revolutionary activity of the men of the Sierra Maestra, and as objects their adherence would have been impossible. At the most, there might have been adhesion, but that is a component of domination, not revolution. In dialogical theory, at no stage can revolutionary action forego communion with the people. Communion, in turn, elicits cooperation, which brings leaders and people to the fusion described by Guevara. This fusion can exist only if revolutionary action is really human, empathetic, loving, communicative, and humble in order to be liberating. The revolution loves and creates life, and in order to create life, it may be obliged to prevent some men from circumscribing life. In addition to the life-death cycle, basic to nature, there is almost an unnatural living death, life which is denied its fullness. It should not be necessary here to cite statistics to show how many Brazilians and Latin Americans in general are living corpses, shadows of human beings, hopeless men, women, and children, victimized by an endless invisible war, in which their remnants of life are devoured by tuberculosis, schistosomiasis, infant diarrhea, by the myriad diseases of poverty, most of which in the terminology of the oppressors are called tropical diseases. Father Chenu makes the following comments regarding possible reactions to situations as extreme as the above. Many, both among the priests attending the council and the informed laymen, fear that in facing the needs and suffering of the world, we may simply adopt an emotional protest in favor of palliating the manifestations and symptoms of poverty and injustice without going on to analyze the causes of the latter, to denounce a regime which encompasses this injustice and engenders his poverty. Unity for Liberation. Whereas in the anti-dialogical theory of action, the dominators are compelled by necessity to divide the oppressed, the more easily to preserve the state of oppression, in the dialogical theory the leaders must dedicate themselves to an untiring effort for unity among the oppressed, and unity of the leaders with the oppressed, in order to achieve liberation. The difficulty is that this category of dialogical action, like the others, cannot occur apart from the praxis. The praxis of oppression is easy, or at least not difficult, for the dominant elite, but it is not easy for the revolutionary leaders to carry out a liberating praxis. The former group can rely on using the instruments of power. The latter group has this power directed against it. The former group can organize itself freely, and though it may undergo fortuitous and momentary divisions, it unites rapidly in the face of any threat to its fundamental interests. The latter group cannot exist without the people, and this very condition constitutes the first obstacle to its efforts at organization. It would indeed be inconsistent of the dominant elite to allow the revolutionary leaders to organize. The internal unity of the dominant elite, which reinforces and organizes its power, requires that the people be divided. The unity of the revolutionary leaders only exists in the unity of the people among themselves and in turn with them. The unity of the elite derives from its antagonism with the people. The unity of the revolutionary leadership group grows out of communion with the united people. The concrete situation of oppression, which dualizes the I of the oppressed, thereby making the oppressed person ambiguous, emotionally unstable, and fearful of freedom, facilitates the divisive action of the dominator by hindering the unifying action indispensable to liberation. Further domination is itself objectively divisive. It maintains the oppressed I in a position of adhesion to a reality which seems all-powerful and overwhelming, and then alienates by presenting mysterious forces to explain this power. Part of the oppressed I is located in the reality to which it adheres. Part is located outside the self in the mysterious forces which are regarded as responsible for a reality about which nothing can be done. The individual is divided between an identical past and present and a future without hope. He or she is a person who does not perceive himself or herself as becoming, hence cannot have a future to be built in unity with others. But as he or she breaks this adhesion and objectifies the reality from which he or she starts to emerge, the person begins to integrate as a subject, an I, confronting an object, reality. At this moment, sundering the false unity of the divided self, one becomes a true individual. To divide the oppressed, an ideology of oppression is indispensable. In contrast, achieving their unity requires a form of cultural action through which they come to know the why and how of their adhesion to reality. It requires de-ideologizing. Hence the effort to unify the oppressed does not call for mere ideological sloganizing. The latter, by distorting the authentic relation between the subject and objective reality, also separates the cognitive, the affective, and the active aspects of the total indivisible personality. The object of dialogical libertarian action is not to dislodge the oppressed from a mythological reality in order to bind them to another reality. On the contrary, the object of dialogical action is to make it possible for the oppressed, by perceiving their adhesion, to opt to transform an unjust reality. Since the unity of the oppressed involves solidarity among them, regardless of their exact status, the unity unquestionably requires class consciousness. However, the submersion in reality which characterizes the peasants of Latin America means that consciousness of being an oppressed class must be preceded or at least accompanied by achieving consciousness of being oppressed individuals. Proposing as a problem to a European peasant, the fact that he or she is a person might strike them as strange. This is not true of Latin American peasants, whose world usually ends at the boundaries of latifundium, whose gestures to some extent simulate those of animals and the trees, and who often consider themselves equal to the latter. Men who are bound to nature and to the oppressor in this way must come to discern themselves as persons prevented from being. And discovering themselves means in the first instance discovering themselves as Pedro, as Antonio, or as Josefa. This discovery implies a different perception of the meaning of designations. The words world, men, culture, tree, work, animal, reassume their true significance. The peasants now see themselves as transformers of reality, previously a mysterious entity, through their creative labor. They discover that, as people, they can no longer continue to be things possessed by others, and they can move from consciousness of themselves as oppressed individuals to the consciousness of an oppressed class. Any attempt to unify the peasants based on activist methods which rely on slogans and do not deal with these fundamental aspects produces a mere juxtaposition of individuals, giving a purely mechanistic character to their action. The unity of the oppressed occurs at the human level, not at the level of things. It occurs in a reality which is only authentically comprehended in the dialectic between the sub and superstructure. In order for the oppressed to unite, they must first cut the umbilical cord of magic and myth which binds them to the world of oppression. The unity which links them to each other must be of a different nature. To achieve this indispensable unity, the revolutionary process must be, from the beginning, cultural action. The methods used to achieve the unity of the oppressed will depend on the latter's historical and existential experience within the social structure. Peasants live in a closed reality with a single compact center of oppressive decision. The urban oppressed live in an expanding context in which the oppressive command center is plural and complex. Peasants are under the control of a dominant figure who incarnates the oppressive system. In urban areas, the oppressed are subjected to an oppressive impersonality. In both cases, the oppressive power is to a certain extent invisible. In the rural zone, because of its proximity to the oppressed, in the cities, because of its dispersion. Forms of cultural action in such different situations as these have, nonetheless, the same objective, to clarify to the oppressed and the objective situation which binds them to the oppressors, visible or not. Only forms of action which avoid mere speech-making and ineffective blah on the one hand, and mechanistic activism on the other, can also oppose the divisive action of the dominant elites and move towards the unity of the oppressed. Organization. In the theory of anti-dialogical action, manipulation is indispensable to conquest and domination. In the dialogical theory of action, the organization of the people presents the antagonistic opposite of this manipulation. Organization is not only directly linked to unity, but is a natural development of that unity. Accordingly, the leader's pursuit of unity is necessarily also an attempt to organize the people, requiring witness to the fact that the struggle for liberation is a common task. This constant, humble, and courageous witness emerging from cooperation in a shared effort, the liberation of women and men, avoids the danger of anti-dialogical control. The form of witness may vary depending on the historical conditions of any society. Witness itself, however, is an indispensable element of revolutionary action. In order to determine the what and how of that witness, it is therefore essential to have an increasingly critical knowledge of the current historical context, the view of the world held by the people, the principal contradiction of society, and the principal aspect of that contradiction. Since these dimensions of witness are historical, dialogical, and therefore dialectical, witness cannot simply import them from other contexts without previously analyzing its own. To do otherwise is to absolutize and mythologize the relative. Alienation then becomes unavoidable. Witness in the dialogical theory of action is one of the principal expressions of the cultural and educational character of the revolution. The essential elements of witness, which do not vary historically, include consistency between words and actions, boldness, which urges the witnesses to confront existence as a permanent risk, radicalization, not sectarianism, leading both the witnesses and the ones receiving that witness to increasing action, courage to love, which far from being accommodation to an unjust world, is rather the transformation of that world in behalf of the increasing liberation of humankind, and faith in the people, since it is to them that witness is made, although witness to the people, because of their dialectical relations with the dominant elites, also affects the latter who respond to that witness in their customary way. All authentic, that is, critical witness involves the daring to run risks, including the possibility that the leaders will not always win the immediate adherence of the people. Witness which has not borne fruit at a certain moment and under certain conditions is not thereby rendered incapable of bearing fruit tomorrow. Since witness is not an abstract gesture but an action, a confrontation with the world and with people, it is not static. It is a dynamic element which becomes part of the societal context in which it occurred. From that moment, it does not cease to affect that context. In anti-dialogical action, manipulation anesthetizes the people and facilitates their domination. In anti-dialogical action, manipulation serves the end of conquest. In dialogical action, daring and loving witness serve the ends of organization. For the dominant elites, organization means organizing themselves. For the revolutionary leaders, organization means organizing themselves with the people. In the first event, the dominant elite increasingly structures its power so that it can be more efficiently dominant and depersonalize. In the second, organization only corresponds to its nature and objective if in itself it constitutes the practice of freedom. Accordingly, the discipline necessary to any organization must not be confused with regimentation. It is quite true that without leadership, discipline, determination, and objectives, without tasks to fulfill and accounts to be rendered, an organization cannot survive, and revolutionary action is thereby diluted. This fact, however, can never justify treating the people as things to be used. The people are already depersonalized by oppression. If the revolutionary leaders manipulate them instead of working towards their conscientisation, the very objective of organization, that is liberation, is thereby negated.